are you?
I'm great. We had an amazing weekend. Oh, it was so great.
I need to throw out a big thank you to everyone who attended the Emerging Collectors Night at the Print Center. Can I quickly shout out those who stood in the Venn diagram of the Print Center and Bridget Meyer Gallery?
Oh, yes, please.
All right, here we go. Alexa from Pie Gallery, Dominique Sammarco, and Brooke Lanier. Those last two are independent artists.
Check them out on the pod.
Yeah, all of them past podcast guests.
Oh, it was so great. It's so good to see them in the wild.
It was insane. Alexa's about to leave for Art Basel the morning after.
Correct. She still stopped in.
And I will be on a plane at 6:30 in the morning.
Yes. To look at some cool art. Cheer, guys. Next year.
Maybe.
Maybe.
We're manifesting it.
Yes.
My husband and I went to the fancy ticketed night at the Prince Center. And then we got to come back to that.
Yes.
But then we linked up with yourself and John and two more of your friends.
Yes, Pat and Kristen.
Pat and Kristen. And then we saw Brian Sanders' Junk.
Oh, a show.
Urban Scuba.
A showcase.
There was several segments, one involving a hammock.
Yep.
One involving a window pane. One involving cellophane swimming, in quotes. One involving a two-dimension pool. One involving a bucket and nearly caused me to...
internal anxiety.
Oh, my God. One involving a coat rack. An ensemble with a bunch of doors. One with a ladder. And one with four lights.
Yeah.
What was your favorite? Which one stands out to you?
I loved the cellophane swimming.
That was good.
I mean,
even when the cellophane wasn't reacting in a way that I think they wanted it to, it was still interesting because it's reacting to the elements and to conditions.
But you were brought into a new space with that art. Mm-hmm. I felt that they were swimming in a pool.
Yeah.
And it was just made of junk. It's just plastic wrap and air.
Yeah.
Just a couple of fans.
Lighting.
And they transformed the audience from the stage to the pool deck.
Yeah. It felt like we were underwater looking up at people doing the breaststroke.
So cool.
So cool. And I have to admit, guys, I did not know what I was getting into.
This was your first Brian Sanders.
Yes. And even farther from that, my husband had no idea what I got us into.
Yes. Yes. I did the same to John.
Worth it.
Yes.
Do more of that.
I want the element of surprise to be part of the art that you're experiencing.
I think there's also room for us to bring on people that are less conventional artists.
100%.
It's tough to find them if you don't know where to find them.
Oh. Maybe? Yes. Yes. And it's hard to find people that are consistently doing this over and over again while continuing to get backed by funders to do it. You know, Brian has been in the game for over 30
decades.
He mentioned the first show in like 1992, guys. And so, you know, he has been around the block and has been able to continuously create weird but immersive art. It's been great. Just in the short time that I've seen him in different iterations, his growth and his ability to like kind of recreate.
How many times have you seen his?
This was probably the fourth show of his that I've been able to see. He mostly did things maybe around like the holiday time, or he would do something like spooky scary.
Ooh.
Yeah, which was really neat.
Let's go back to the Print Center's fundraiser, and let's talk about bidding, Mr. Paddle number 42.
Oh my gosh, how do you know my 42 number?
I looked at what I knew you bid on, and it said highest bidder. Number 42.
Yes.
And I was like, I think that's his bid.
Talk about an amazing opportunity. I mean, to take an artist that we've spoken with on the pod and then be able to in and buy his art.
The money, it all went to the Prince Center.
Yes, to benefit them for their 100th and 10th anniversary.
And the party, the fancy pants party was great. You know how there's the monitor when you first walk up to the second flight?
Yeah.
And there was a monitor installed on the first floor as well. It ran a slideshow of each piece, and it let you know where the bidding was.
Oh, wow.
So you could kind of keep tabs. And listen, I would have bought anything I bid on. Maybe put bids down that I would be okay if I didn't get it.
Yeah.
This is going to make it more attractive to somebody else.
Yeah.
And I'm going to put a bid down, and then I'm going to walk away. I started bidding on Lot 63, Ron Tarver, Dogwood Study Number 1, 2006, which I was outbid on. In the last minutes, and I lost track of the auction. I won Lot 71, the Christine Walensky Untitled 2025. It's like a graphite on paper.
Mm-hmm.
I won Lot 90, the Fleischer Art Memorial gift certificate.
Nice.
And I was outbid on 93 Rescue Spa facial gift certificate. I impulsively drove up the price on Untitled 2003, the lot number 43 from Richard Polsky. And what did you buy? I don't think you shared.
I did not share. I won the winning bid for John Joyce's piece, Ian.
The barber. I told John Joyce several weeks ago that you were going to bid on that once I saw that it was available. I was like, I'm not going to tell him I told you. Let's just wait and see.
Yes. It was so good. I'm so happy. I can't wait to put it on the wall.
After we sat down for dinner after the Prince Center event of ours,
yeah,
you literally said, okay, I need to register and put a bid in right
yes.
now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Felt so inspired. And even more after he speaks about his work.
In the Palladium process.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. It's so cool and different.
And you could put that thing in the sun.
Yes, and it won't even matter. It'll stay like that forever and ever.
Forever and ever. Okay, so speaking of the Prince Center Emerging Collectors Night, we're about to be joined in conversation by two podcast guests who were also in attendance there. So
yes.
Guys, stick around.
On to the conversation. This is Robert Marsh, and you're listening to Philly Has Heart podcast. In this podcast, we sit down with artists, gallerists, educators, curators, and other creatives who comprise the Philadelphia art world to discuss upcoming performances, exhibits, and other events and initiatives that are not to be missed. The art scene in Philadelphia is so rich that it can seem daunting. Consider this your weekend cultural recommendation. With me always is my producer, Lucinda Deggerland.
Hello, hello.
And today we have Vasiliki and Bella, amazing scientists. I want to start by thanking Girls Like Horror, all of us who were able to go and see the Philadelphia Ballet through that partnership. Can you, or one, start by sharing what your journey was like? How did you get to the science of art, be it dance or architecture?
The Girls Like Horror thing is so fun because I was actually at the first screening because I have been friends with JP and Christina for years now and didn't really consider myself a girl who liked horror all that much until I got more into it, and now it's part of what I study and what I'm going to continue to study.
I love it.
My journey has been interdisciplinary, like a lot of people in the lab. I studied neuroscience and art history and architecture in undergrad just because I couldn't choose anything.
Taking a wide breath here.
I was like,
this combination of things covers everything I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic in my senior year of college, I was able to connect with scientists online and go to all these Zoom lectures.
Wow.
And I found out about the Penn Center for Neuroaesthetics. So that was my first post-college job. I moved out here to Philadelphia from California to work with Anjan Chatterjee and all of the other scientists. A really perfect intersection of my interests.
Yes, definitely.
So I was very happy to be here. I met the girls like her through Bella. Basically, she just told me, I'm going to this ballet performance with some of my friends. Are you going to come? I don't really watch many horror movies. I'm a neuroscientist, and I also work at the Penn Center for Neuroaesthetics. I also have a kind of non-linear background, like the journey. I'm originally from Greece, so I studied my undergrad in Greece in sociology. And then I moved to the UK, where I lived for 5 years, and I studied psychology for my master's. I learned about neuroscience, so I started working on it, neuroscience creativity, and I did my PhD in London on dance. I am not a professional dancer, but I always liked dance and I liked neuroscience. So I tried to find a way that I can combine both into one. So I found my PhD advisor who does neuroscience and dance. So I did my PhD with her. And after that, I met our current advisor, Anjan Chatterjee, through the different collaborations and conferences. I moved to Philly to come to the lab, and I've been working in the lab for 3 years, and I have some dance projects on the side, but my main job here is on architecture and the aesthetics of architecture, how we perceive the built environment, how our body acts to it, and potential well-being benefits that we might have from the built environment and in nature.
Wow, that's incredible.
Amazing. Ugh. I love that. Yes. I work in the built environment. I'm obsessed.
And one thing to know about this field is that there are not very many of us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As you can imagine, the science of aesthetics is about 100 years old, and there are maybe a dozen labs in the world that have it as their primary focus.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Some people are approaching the subject tangentially or occasionally, but in the United States, here in Philly is like the place to be studying this. That's
Excellent.
Why it attracts scholars from all over the world.
Yes, that's incredible.
And also, yeah. What a culturally rich city for it to be located. I mean, can you imagine if it were in Omaha? But
it would be different.
The architecture,
yes.
And you have the numerous dance companies.
Yeah, we do our project in so many different places. Like, normally you do your studies in the lab. Mm-hmm. So people can come to the university to do the studies. But here we can do studies in museums, in the street, because we have all those murals. Mm-hmm. So there are many ways that you can study what we study. And especially in Philly, there are so many options. And usually people are very open to collaborate with scientists, which is also great.
What is an aesthetic experience, and how can you study it?
I'd say aesthetic experience is your personal encounter with an object just for the sake of it, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You might appreciate the object for its beauty, for the emotions it creates to you. It's more than focusing on the utility of an object, but the personal experience that you have with it.
Mm-hmm.
It can be an object, can be a performance. For some people, it's sports. So it really varies. In the lab, we have a cognitive model of how we approach the aesthetic experience, which has the sensory motor aspects of it. So how we move, if it's about a space or a big painting, let's say, how you move around it to see the different parts of it, what you see, if there is a smell, if there is a tactile sensation, the knowledge and meaning that comes with it, what you know about the object, your personal experiences, and the emotion evaluation. How do you feel about it?
Right.
It's still pretty debated in the field whether aesthetic experiences really are a class of their own, mm-hmm. and whether aesthetic emotions are really like a real class, because you have all sorts of other reward experiences, and maybe the brain is just processing things as a reward. The defining thing about aesthetics is that it's not necessary for survival.
Right. Mm.
Right. So why do we care anyways?
It's like a luxury.
But why do we feel mm-hmm. so compelled to make and engage with works throughout mm-hmm. all of human history? There's got to be some special sauce there.
100%. Mm-hmm. And is it that when you're studying this, are you monitoring the brain waves? Are you monitoring the space and as like a piece of art? Are you monitoring someone walking into a room and what they're doing within that room? Or is it also based on like surveys of an experience by that individual afterwards?
Because we are scientists and because the field is unconventional, perhaps, mm-hmm. we control everything.
Nice.
So all of those things, we administer surveys to people. We use physiological trackers to measure how people's heart rate is changing, how the electrical conductance of their skin is changing. And we occasionally do MRI studies where we're looking at, if we show someone a specific picture and we're asking them to be thinking about a specific question mm-hmm. in relation to it, how did blood flow change in the brain? Mm-hmm. Where is blood moving to? And that tells you what systems are engaged at a particular moment and how they relate to other systems at rest state.
Gotcha.
We actually have our MRI data processing right now. Like, at the very moment.
You're multitasking.
The computers have been crunching for weeks, and we're going to have results so soon from that latest study.
Wow. Wow. What was the latest, if you can talk about it?
It was in the framework of the model Vasiliki mentioned. So how does our brain integrate emotional information, conceptual high-level information, and basic sensory features? And when we're hypothesizing that if you tell someone to focus on a specific aspect of that, so only focus on the sensory details mm-hmm. and the physical properties of the piece, that you're going to see a smaller subset of the brain engaged than if you ask them about what new knowledge have you gained from the piece.
Yeah.
So we're looking at how these different regions and networks connect to each other to provide an aesthetic experience. But the more interesting thing is, how can we tease them apart and figure out the ingredients? Is that a fair representation?
Yes, yeah. And in a paradigm like this, in order to get information from the brain, we conduct the study in a really unnatural environment. So we cannot do it in a museum, but in a loud fMRI scanner, people wear headphones and earplugs underground in a hostel facility. You cannot collect the same information if you're in a museum. So it's always a balance what kind of information we can collect and under what environments. So in another study that we're conducting right now with Bella, we have a collaboration with a substance abuse rehabilitation clinic in Maryland, Alpas Wellness. And there, for example, our question is more about the built environment mm-hmm. and how nature-inspired elements or so-called biophilic design has the potential to improve the well-being of people using the space.
Mm-hmm.
So there we have refresh rooms, and people use the room, and we collect their heart rate and other physiological measures to see how their body reacts to the space while watching videos with music, and they have blankets and things like this that they can get cozy. And we ask them how they feel before and after. So this is another example of like one of the many studies that we they have in the lab, just to give you a different, like an idea of a different environment that we might be running studies.
Right.
Yeah, and when we have Penn undergrads come into the lab, they'll answer surveys for hours because they are used to that environment. When we work with people who are in the first few days of sobriety and their nervous systems are really running haywire, we have to rely a lot more on the physiology because people are not able to sit down and tell us in excruciating detail how they feel.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They might not know.
How about the work that you did with dance experience? Can you share a little bit about that?
The main project that I have worked on was for my PhD, was how dancers process emotions of other people in their brain, and whether this is different, not better or worse, different than people with no prior dance experience. And we saw that there were some differences in the brain on this. So we had people come in the lab, we put the EEG cup with all the gel, and people saw faces with different emotions, and we were collecting their brain waves.
Right.
And their heart rate as well. And we were able to see these differences. They also feel differently with their body. They have usually better awareness of their body signals, different body parts. If they feel pain, they have better understanding of the type of pain and where it is. So I think this is fascinating, how we can use dancers as a model of cognition to better understand our brains, and how now we, with other colleagues on dance, we try to show how dance can be used as a vehicle to understand cognition. So how you move in the space. Well, how about testing how dancers move into the space, for example? How do you train to move with other people around you in your personal space? These are just some of the examples that we have been working on. Recently, also, I took a different approach, and I worked with a choreographer in New York who wanted to use the results of my PhD and create a dance performance out of it. So this is a different collaboration that we can have with artists, how you can use neuroscience as inspiration and a different way to communicate science, maybe to in a more loose way to an audience that maybe wouldn't get this information otherwise.
Right. Right. Wow. I think it's so fascinating to, especially to some of the dancers, maybe even at the ballet, to have a better awareness of their bodies, but then also their minds and how they interact with the environment that they're put in. Right. At one point, they're in a studio with all of their peers, with their boss, with music free-flowing as well, in a big white room with mirrors everywhere, to then pushed into a stage in which the audience might go dark and you can't see all of the faces or how many eyes you have on you, and how that can totally change that dancer's experience from that one environment to the next.
Yeah, I mean, even if you go in a dance class and they ask you to move the other way, not face the mirrors anymore, but face it, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
The first few tries are complete disaster because you're not used to this side of the room.
Right. You've totally changed the environment just by taking away the mirrors.
Yes.
Oh, I love that. I love it. Can you tell us about the aesthetics of architecture?
It's a really hot field right now, really developing. One of the ideas our lab is interested in is this one that our dwellings have changed a lot in the last few hundred years. Mm-hmm. We now live in cities. We now live in concrete and glass buildings, mostly alone. And our brains have not changed in the same amount of time. from when we used to live as hunter-gatherers in villages and smaller communities with more permeable dwellings. And so that's why we're interested in the hypothesis that biophilic-inspired spaces can perhaps restore attention, perhaps improve cognition, or reduce stress. Those are some of the things that we're testing in our current work. And designers have this intuition, right, adding nature-inspired elements to a space will make people feel more comfortable. The science is far behind that intuition.
Okay.
So we're working on those questions to hopefully inform design that's more human-oriented.
Wow. I work in the education field, and you can see the behavior in children when there's a classroom that is set up orderly and with intention, creating a more organized environment for the children versus chaos in the environment that is created. There are student art all over the wall. There is chaos in the little library nook in the corner, and how those environments can then change the way that children act and learn in one environment from one classroom to another. Because one school could have 10 different classrooms of different grades, and each one of those teachers are bringing their own environment to there. And so how do you find the best environment to then be able to educate kids in? And that might change from kindergarten classroom to an eighth grade classroom. And so that's fascinating how you can look at architecture and how architecture can then change the way that we act and behave and
think.
Think, yeah.
Think, grow, develop, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought education, because the past years, well, a few decades ago, there was this effort to have everything with no distraction. And I think that's quite depriving at the end. There's sensory deprivation. And now they start to bring more color and more tactile elements. So we have three concepts that we kind of work with in the lab for architecture: coherence, fascination, and hominess. You want the place to be coherent when you study, if that's what works for you.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's too boring, or maybe it doesn't feel comfortable for you. There is always a trade-off, and no space will work for everybody. We often have architects asking for cheat codes, and we're like, we're sorry, we don't have that. We can't really
What is the best building for the brain?
Yes.
That's an impossible question.
It doesn't exist. You always have to work with the needs of the inhabitants. So the best way is to ask them. And it doesn't matter really if you ask them after everything is built, because then maybe you cannot change it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to understand how people think and move into the space, even navigation,
mm-hmm.
special navigation, like finding the studio when you enter the mall. It's not always intuitive, or it's not all aspects of the human experience in the built environment. So we're trying to figure this out.
Yeah. Is there an example of a space that has done that well?
Well, our refresh room in the clinic has worked very well. I mean, honestly, we don't want to brag, but it worked well. People,
yeah.
It's the only space for the patients in the clinic that can be alone. And they're usually in a lot of stress physically, mm-hmm. and emotionally. When they enter the room, many of them will fall asleep in seconds.
Wow.
And we did read...
Can I join the study?
She needs rest.
Sorry, go ahead, Noah.
We did some preliminary studies in our lab, and we also reviewed the literature to find, at least as far as we know, what amount of wood should we bring into mm-hmm. the space? We wanted dim lighting because that had shown some restorative effects versus harsh overhead lighting. Things that are totally intuitive to designers, but mm-hmm. not empirically proven necessarily.
Gotcha.
So we gathered this information, and one of the things about our lab that is interesting compared to other neuroscientists is we're often filling various roles. Like, we will be designing and ordering products from West Elm and making SketchUp diagrams.
Yes.
And I have, on occasion, built furniture for our experiments.
Perfect.
We've also studied, we're still actively collecting data for that, the built environment in virtual reality, which is a different aspect, a different type of research because, you know, it's cheaper, easier to test things instead of building and rebuilding. I know there is this trend in architecture to use VR, maybe to show the space in a more immersive way to the clients. So we try to incorporate virtual reality as well, and that allows us to test different populations.
Right, and figure out, like, when you're translating something from real into virtual, what gets translated over and what perhaps falls off about, like, your spatial perception or your sense of embodiment in a space. Like, some things might be a trade-off.
Can you let us know about the psychology of public art, maybe focusing on Philly's murals themselves?
Philly, as you mentioned, is a great city to study art, and more particularly a great space to study mural arts and public arts. We're in touch with Mural Arts and are maybe going to write a grant together. We'll see. Some of the research we have so far looks at these guided tours of art in West Philly and Center City, and we're taking Penn undergrads out of their comfort zone. And one of the things we wanted to see is if the neighborhood was previously unfamiliar to them, how does the public art change their perception before and after? And we're seeing some results of that, that it's perceived as less noisy when they go to Center City after looking at the murals. In West Philadelphia, west of 52nd, they perceive less crime and less litter. So we're really interested in pushing that forward and probing more deep introspection at the murals to see how deep people are willing to go and if that relates to how they perceive the neighborhood. That's a undergrad we have running that study. She's amazing.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, and the way we understand better how people feel about the murals and generally about the art that we show them, it's not only if they find it beautiful and if they like it. This is what most studies have done in aesthetics for many years when it started. But lately, we, not only our lab, but other labs that are currently working on neuroaesthetics, we try to go deeper because it's not only about beauty. Maybe it makes you feel terrible. That's perfect. We need to know that.
Right.
And only asking beauty and liking is not enough. So in the lab, we have this taxonomy of impacts, aesthetic and emotional impacts. So we will ask people, and I think that's relevant for the murals as well, because the murals often have social meaning, especially in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
They're community-oriented. They have something more related to the society. It's not just something pretty. And we will ask people, is it challenging? Do you feel confused? Do you feel edified? Do you feel angry, upset? We really try to capture both good and negative, let's say, emotions, because sometimes these can provide a richer experience aesthetically when you see art that challenges you.
Yeah.
Like, why does it challenge you? What is the aspect that creates that? And is it personal? Is it the art? How do you connect with it? And we also ask them to give us free responses, how they feel, in case we can get something extra out of their experience.
That's such an incredible question, especially because as murals are popping up across the city, I believe even from the muralists, that artists that we've spoken to, they're trying to find ways to connect that piece of art to that community. Yes. And sometimes for a viewer that isn't from the community, is it too niche to the community that it's then not speaking to someone outside of the community as much? And would that blank space have been better off making something that inspired everyone to come into the community versus just lifting up the smaller community that's around it?
Well, actually, I have some data on that.
I love that. Oh, my gosh.
We did this massive online study where we were trying to create a more inclusive database of artworks for other experimenters to use. A lot of people in our field will use Matisse, Picasso, you know, a lot of the masters that are in the public domain now. And we don't feel that's representative of aesthetic experiences. So we collected these artworks informed by experts in art history, African art, Latin American art, religious art, murals. Missing two categories. Murals was one of the categories of the artworks that we collected for this diverse database. And when we ran the massive online study to see how people felt about the pieces and get average ratings across a diverse population, murals stood out the most in terms of what people liked the most, what they felt was the most transformative. These were not people from Philadelphia. These were people from all over the United States. And I think one of the things that a good mural will do well is immediately pull you into its story. Because they're meant to be engaging.
Yes.
It's a tool. And good mural artists know how to leverage that tool to really draw the viewer in and make them think critically. All artists do that well, but maybe with the murals, the narrative is more immediately clear. We don't really know. Maybe it's just the ones we picked. But the murals were the top rated in that whole study.
Oh, my gosh. That's incredible.
And they were all film murals.
Yeah.
That's the beautiful. Fun bit. Well, thank you both for sharing your time with us today.
Yeah, thank you for asking. We're often in our little scientific bubble.
Thank you for having us.
No, thank you for sharing your time as well as your work. For both of you, where can our audience find you online?
If you want to find out more about the research we do, our website is neuroaesthetics.med.upenn.edu. That's a bit of a challenging
search.
If you look up like Brain Art Philly, I'm 99% confident you'll find us.
Yes. We're rolling into some rapid fire questions.
I'm ready.
Favorite architect?
Bernard Schumi. And that's, I feel like I should say, the architect that we know through our work, but Bernard Schumi.
American one, I would say Lloyd Wright, Frank Lloyd Wright.
Also a big fan of Frank Gehry, so the news recently.
My gosh. Favorite Philadelphia neighborhood?
I used to live above Jim's Steaks on 4th and South, and I loved it there so much. I love South Street. I've moved since, but there's just a special energy there.
For me, it would be Gaborhood, but below Walnut Street, where it's like Queen Street, like all the little streets there, where the cobble streets. I used to walk my dog there a lot, and I love this area.
Go-to horror movie.
I feel like I'm constantly telling people about Raw, which is a really intense body horror movie about a vegetarian who goes to vet school and then crazy things happen. Do you know this movie?
No. We're gonna go down Wikipedia wormholes tonight. I just know it.
It's a cannibal movie.
On that note,
cheesesteaks with whiz or without?
Without provolone.
Without American cheese.
Favorite Philadelphia mural?
It wasn't my favorite initially, but I did this study on challenging art, and reading people's responses to it was so uplifting. I don't know the title of it, but it's a mural of a black man and his black daughter sitting on his shoulder, and they're sharing a kiss, and there are hibiscus flowers, And in the study, people felt so compelled by this mural and the positive depiction of Black and Brown fathers that it was really moving to me. This is my favorite now.
My favorite so far, I would say, is the one on in Gayborhood next to 12th Street. It's above a community garden. And the mural itself is a depiction of a community garden, of a garden.
Oh, yeah.
And it's in our database. It's beautiful because you have the community garden and then you have the mural that is so colorful, so beautiful, and then you have the sky. For me, it's amazing. I loved seeing this mural.
Favorite ballet?
I don't know.
That's okay. No, it's okay. It's a new space.
Is Alvin Ailey considered ballet?
Of course.
It's a company.
I like seeing their pieces.
So from the Philadelphia Ballet, I think my favorite performance would be Carmen. Carmen had something different.
Yeah.
And it was so passionate in a way that I hadn't seen ballet before. And I loved it. So I think it would be Carmen. And then from other companies, I think I could agree with Alvin Ailey. When I saw Alvin Ailey last year in Philly, early this year, I was just amazed by their talent.
Well, thank you again so much, guys.
Thank you.
Let's check out the spaces around you and question them a little more now. Incredible, incredible work. We are in the thick of holiday programming. For this weekend, we have Philadelphia Ballet's The Nutcracker is continuing its run through the end of the year at the Academy of Music.
We will be there. But also, Ballet X is offering counter-programming to all of The Nutcracker with their programming at Bryn Mawr from December 12th through the 14th.
One night only, on the 14th, Philadelphia Chamber Music Society presents Juilliard Quartet, featuring Marc-Andre Hamlin on the piano at the Kimmel Center.
Actually, that PCMS production is sold out, so good luck trying to score tickets on the secondary market.
Ooh.
But on the 16th, the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society presents Matthew Pulenzano, tenor, and Ken Noda on the piano, also at the Kimmel Center.
This is your last week to check out Steve Rydell's I Want the West at Larry Becker Contemporary Art. It closes on the 20th.
Ongoing gallery shows throughout December.
Colors of the Season, the Muse Gallery annual members show.
Pie Gallery's Patricia Moss Freeland's The Stillness Between Us.
Third Street Gallery under $500 show, an annual member show.
And into the new year until February, Materiality, a group show at Bridget Meyer Gallery. Before signing off, Robert, do you have any plans for this weekend?
I have some Christmas brunches, I think Ballet X, and just out to see the art.
Philly has heart.
And art. Heart, where we get to know the people at the heart of Philadelphia culture. Follow us, share the love, and tune in on Thursdays for your weekly cultural update.